Welcome to Cultimatum, the podcast uncovering the dark realities of cults and human trafficking. I'm your host, Anonymous Andrew, and each week we dive deep into the manipulation, control, and courageous escapes that define these worlds.
And I'm Melody, Andrew's co-host. Having experienced the depth of a cult firsthand, specifically the House of Yahweh, I am here as an advocate for fellow survivors.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own and do not reflect the official policy or position of Cultimatum or its affiliates. The content discussed on this podcast are based on personal experiences and should not be construed as factual or legal advice. Neither the host nor the guest are liable for any statements made during the episodes. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and seek professional advice where appropriate.
And before we dive into today's episode, we want to issue a trigger warning. Some episodes may cover explicit and potentially disturbing subjects such as sexual abuse, rape, human trafficking, suicide, and other sensitive subjects. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, Cultimatum fans, before we dive into today's episode, we need a tiny favor from each of you.
That's right. If you love what you hear, please take a moment to rate and review us on Apple and Spotify.
Your support helps us to reach new listeners and bring more awareness and attention to these important topics.
So tap that star rating, drop a quick review, and help us spread the word. It really does make a difference.
Thank you so much for tuning in and for your amazing support. We truly appreciate each and every one of you. Now let's get started with the show.
Here we go. Greetings and welcome to another episode of Cultimatum Podcast, a culture of cults and human trafficking. My name is Anonymous Andrew, and tonight with me is my co-host, Melody. Hello, Melody.
Hi, Andrew. Today's guest is Michael Lush, a former Jehovah's Witness and author of a powerful trilogy of ebooks chronicling 20 years of poetry written during his time in the group. His memoir tells of a raw and brutal story, but also shows how art can be a path to healing. Micah is also one of the producers of the documentary Witnesses Underground, a film that explores the hidden struggles and voices of ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. He's a strong voice in the ex-JW community and uses his platform, especially on Facebook, to speak out against cult abuse and offer support through creativity, humor, and truth. We're excited to talk with him about his journey, his art, and how he's turning pain into power. Micah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yes, Micah, welcome to the show. Okay, where would you like to begin?
Well, I was born to first-generation Jehovah's Witnesses in 1982. Do not know for sure when my parents joined and can't find out now, but I'm guessing in the late 70s, which after leaving, I found out there was kind of a mass exodus of Jehovah's Witnesses because of a claim in 75 that was Armageddon. At a convention, they said stay alive until 1975. There were people who quit college, gave up their investments, lost their houses. So I really don't know if my parents were aware of that or not, but being a Jehovah's Witness was all I knew. I was not allowed to know anyone else in my family. I think I met my cousins on my mother's side 3 or 4 times, and I feared them because, you know, I was told that everyone outside of Jehovah's Witnesses, they were under Satan's control. And from the time I was born, I was told that I needed to look and watch for opportunities to speak to people effectively to help save their lives, because if I didn't, I would be blood guilty. And that could mean that my God would kill me when Armageddon came. And I really, looking back with clarity, I was a child slave. I cleaned kingdom halls and dress clothes, and my life was one of just constant paralytic terror. And, you know, that was really just all I knew. It was meetings 3 times a week. I would prepare for those, usually an hour or more. I was expected to answer. I started giving public talks at 7 or 8 years old. And of course, you know, I had to. I was also told as a young child by my mother that if I didn't serve Jehovah, that I had to while I was growing up. But if I didn't, when I was older, she would always love me, but she wouldn't be a part of my life. And everything changed for me when I was 13. My father died. He was diagnosed with cancer when I was 12. And so I watched him take chemotherapy, and it was very harsh, very brutal. And I really pray fervently to my God, and I would plead with him and tell him how much I needed my father. And when it was evident that things weren't really improving for him, his doctors recommended a blood transfusion. They said, you know, it might help. You know, it was a pretty bad situation. But still, that would have been an effort that he had tried. But my father remained loyal to his God and said no. That changed my whole life, as you would expect the death of a child would. But it also changed it in another way. Because, you know, cult members are expected to be walking, talking as advertisements for the group to draw in people. And I was never the same. I didn't feel happy. I've also come to understand that you really can't grieve in a group like that, because anger is one of the stages of grief, and you're not allowed to be angry. And you're certainly not allowed to express the anger that I felt, because I had heard of other people say, well, perhaps it was their cousin or someone was sick and Jehovah save them, and he didn't save my father. And I just thought, how dare you? You have this infinite power. And of course, I couldn't say that, and I couldn't even really think it. But that's the thought crime element. But what I noticed was I began connecting with dark things like the writings of Edgar Allan Poe. I really liked Stephen King. I discovered heavy metal. I loved Metallica. And I was always told those things were bad and wrong and evidence of my sinful inclination. But not only that, I could sense animosity from my congregation and from my mother. And despite hearing from the stage that the fatherless boy should be looked after, people really began treating me like garbage. And I was baptized less than 4 months after my father's death. I only know because I found a bracelet my mother hadn't given me, with the date engraved on it. And one time I said, I remembered the day, but I didn't remember the date. And somebody told me I wasn't worthy to serve Jehovah. And I remember how crushing that was, just how devastating. And things like that just kept happening. I was angry, you know, and I don't even really know if I certainly didn't comprehend on what level, you know, it was just my dead father was dangled in front of me like a carrot. And I just thought, I have to get through this day and hopefully tomorrow Armageddon will start and then I can see my dad again. But when I was 16, one night after church, my friend and I decided to hit mailboxes. And, you know, teenage boys are stupid. But we wound up being arrested. And we went to juvenile and our parents got us. And so we had to go speak to the elders individually. And I remember I was afraid that I would be disfellowshipped, which meant that I would be shunned. And it was staggering to me as I sat there how the elders spoke to me. They told me that people knew the witnesses represented Jehovah, and they told me to think about the men who arrested me and what if I had caused them to reject God. And that meant, yet again, that God would kill me at Armageddon. And I remember sitting there feeling, and I did feel guilty because I was a dumb teenager. After the fact, I thought, oh, wow, these people have to pay to fix that. You know, I just didn't think of that. But people acted, I mean, they acted like I'd killed people. You know, nobody said, hey, are you okay? You just buried your father. Maybe, you know, there was no compassion, no empathy. It was just, it was ridiculous. But they told me that I would be publicly reproved. And
Micah, can I jump in?
Yes.
What you said that you were doing what to mailboxes?
We were driving past and hitting them with mail bat.
Oh, so you were destroying them.
Yeah. And
yeah. Okay. No, when I was a kid, we did the same thing. The 12-year-old, 14-year-olds, we would steal the Playboys out of the mailboxes.
Yeah.
Then they delivered Playboys still to the homes. So, oh. But no, okay, never mind. Keep going.
No, you're good. So, yeah, you know, it really seemed disproportionate because I thought in my mind, okay, yes, that was stupid. I don't really know why I did it. It seemed like a fun idea. And it was fun while I did it. But then when I saw, oh, well, you know, I'd frighten people and all that, it certainly wasn't worth it. And and that was the other thing. I regretted it. I felt bad. We met with our victims. We paid them restitution. And we talked. We went around in a circle. And you want to talk about a room full of people that hate you. But after they talked to us, people shook our hands and hugged us. And an elderly couple told us, you're good boys. You just did a stupid thing. And that was very confusing because Jehovah's Witnesses, who are the best people, treated me like a murderer almost. And these evil worldly people forgave me. But of course, I didn't really think about that until years later. I just continued being a Jehovah's Witness. You know, when I was 18, I just couldn't stand it anymore. I hated everything about my life. And I was quiet, introverted, and, you know, I was always getting pulled into the back room for elders to counsel me. Why did you wear a black suit? Well, I like black. Well, what if that offended somebody? And, you know, I would ask questions. Why would that offend anyone? That doesn't make sense to me. And of course, that's my rebellious nature. Why are you wearing a shirt with a skull on it? Well, I like it. Well, that seems evil. Well, how is that evil when we all have a skull in our head? I would always question them, you know, but of course, there were those roadblocks. And honestly, it was my dead father, I think, that really kept me in line more. But I got, you know, privately reproved for things like, you know, looking at a Playboy, watching an R movie, you know, ridiculous things. But of course, at the time when I'm doing them, I feel like angels are watching me and you're told you're making God sad, you know, because I've watched Pulp Fiction. And, you know, a lot of it did seem stupid and I would mock it, but yet again, it was all I knew. But yeah, by the time I got out of high school, I weighed 300 pounds and I was just in this horrific depression. And, you know, it started to happen that when I would go to the Kingdom Hall, people wouldn't acknowledge me. I would look them in the eyes and say, hello, you know, and they would pretend they didn't hear me and walk away. And of course, you're told to go to the church leadership. So I would tell the elders, and it, of course, it was always, well, they heard you. You've mistaken. Did you try again? You haven't put yourself out there. You know, that just went on and on and on for years. And even I used to wear contacts and I would take them out when I went to the Kingdom Hall so I didn't have to see the people I was around, because I knew, despite everyone telling me that nothing was happening, I knew I was being ignored and acted as if I didn't exist. So when I was 23, or no, I jumped ahead a little bit. When I was 20, or the week I turned 21, I overdosed on sleeping pills and I essentially died. I was found and someone called an ambulance and I woke up tied to a hospital bed. I was in a coma for 37 hours and no compassion, no empathy, just judgment.
Can I ask, mm-hmm. Is that done on purpose or you were just popping pills?
It was intentional. Okay. You know, I was 21 and I had spent from the age 13 pretty much just getting pushed out further and further in my only community. Okay. And people outside of it, I remember I worked with this beautiful blonde at White Castle. And I don't know why, but everybody's telling me, hey, you should ask her out. She wants to hang out with you. And she was 2 years older than me. And I said no. And at the time, I was proud that I had been strong for my God and thinking, you know, like, you know, these are the things that are going to get me to paradise so I can see my father again. And yeah, I just couldn't deal with it anymore. And I figured I'll either die and it'll be like I'm asleep or before I was born. That's the belief of Jehovah's Witnesses. Or I figured I'll wake up in paradise and see my father. You know, either one is better than this.
Well, and you know what? I'm going to pop in here for a minute, Micah. I think part of the, it sounds to me like a lot of the problem is that you weren't allowed to properly grieve. And my cult did the same thing where you're not allowed to go through that grieving process because basically you're told the lie when you're in the group that you're not going to die, right? Your mom and dad were probably told you're not going to die because Armageddon is coming and the end is coming. The end is always near. It's always right around the corner. So in order to preserve their own lies, they can't allow you to grieve properly. And then and then basically you're ostracized because you couldn't grieve and you couldn't go through that process in the proper manner that most people do when they're not in a group like that.
Yes, that they said around the corner. And even people, my mother told me that I needed to get over my dead father. She told me that her loss was greater than mine. Other people told me I was just using an excuse. So, you know, I mean, I just felt like the lowest of the low. And every time I was around people, almost they were just horrible to me or they acted like I didn't exist. And of course, from the stage, you're hearing, we are just filled with love. And aren't we thrilled to come to the Kingdom Hall? And I despised it. But when I was 23, I dated a Jehovah's Witness, and that was not a good relationship. But when it ended, I had stayed overnight with her. I hadn't slept with her, but we had engaged in activity that Jehovah's Witnesses would call porneia, which I think is from the Greek. It's like a type of sexual immorality. And so I felt guilt, right? And I felt like God is reaching out to me and like essentially tapping me on the shoulder. You need to go to the elders. And so I did. I was honest with them about what happened. And they spoke to her. And then I met with them a second time. And they had changed their tone a lot, how they were with me. And they dismissed me from the room. And they're in there for 45 minutes to an hour, I would say. It was an eternity. And I'm sitting there the whole time thinking, if I'm disfellowshipped, that means God will remove his Holy Spirit from me. And I'm terrified of that. So I go in and one of the elders said, "We don't believe you didn't have sex with her, because why wouldn't you?" And of course, I didn't, because I believe sex was only for marriage. And, you know, we had stopped things. And, you know, I'm thinking they're I don't know what the elder thing is, but I'm thinking the Holy Spirit is in there and they're, you know, I'm thinking a supernatural thing is happening. And then they just called me a liar. But of course, I went along with it when they announced at the time, they've changed their rules now, but they announced that I had been disfellowshipped, and they told me I needed to come to the Kingdom Hall and sit there, because that would show that I was repentful and agreed with the decision. And so I did. I sat there and I was shunned for, I think, about 18 months. And you have to write a reinstatement letter, or at least you had to at the time. And my first one said, "Well, I think I should be reinstated because I've made all the meetings, I've been studying, and you people act like I don't exist anyway. There really isn't any difference between me being shunned and not being shunned." So I thought that was a key point. Of course, they didn't like that. So they told me I would need to write another letter. And so I got online and I searched for how to write a reinstatement letter, which I shouldn't have been doing. But I remember I found an apostate. It said kind of you needed to have this tone. So I copied that, gave it to them, and they loved it. They ate it up and they just praised me. And so I was reinstated. And it was interesting. I'd seen other people be reinstated, and, you know, and people would come around them and hug them. A couple people did. But for the most part, people didn't seem to care. Then I had pretty much another 10 years of misery, just not existing. And I would have periods where they would call it inactive, but I wouldn't go to meetings. I hated going to meetings. You already had to sit there and study it. And then you already knew what, you know, and then they repeat it, and then someone raises their hand to read from it. It's just regurgitation and this nonstop, incessant thing.
Micah?
Yes.
Maybe I missed something, but you said something along the lines around 18, 19, you had it with them. You were wearing Skull shirts or Metallica shirts, and you were being called in for that. And then at the age of 23, you were dating somebody, a woman in JW, and you felt guilty about, you weren't having intercourse, but you were doing other things. And we can only imagine what they are, because these are imaginations. And you felt guilty, and you went, and they made you write this letter to be reinstated instead of being shunned. Why?
Well, no.
That was your out.
Well, yeah. So I was shunned, and then eventually to come back. Well, you know, I don't know how to answer that, except I still believed it was the truth. You know, I wanted my father back. You know, that it was almost like I had blinders on, and I just thought, this is horrific. And I know people treat me like garbage, but when I'm perfect and they're perfect, they'll accept me and I'll get my dad back. I really looked up to my father, and people would praise him for, you know, being loyal to his God. And it had a very profound effect on me. And of course, I felt...
How would you get your dad back?
I'm sorry. So Jehovah's Witnesses believe after Armageddon and all the sinners are killed, 144,000 will go to heaven to rule with God, but everyone else will grow young again and live forever on the earth because, well, it doesn't matter why, but that's what they believe. And there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the unrighteous. And my father had died loyal. So, I mean, it was assured that he would come back, you know?
Okay.
And so, and like Melody said earlier, Armageddon's right around the corner. You know, it's almost like the passing of time. It's totally different, you know, outside of it as opposed to inside, because we were told to live in expectation of Jehovah's Day of Judgment. And I did. And I would say I was a more liberal Jehovah's Witness, but I believed I was right. It's okay to listen to Ozzy Osbourne and Metallica and dress this way, and people, and when we're perfect, people will realize that. That's just their imperfection. Everything is imperfection, you know? So I, you know, it's funny you would ask, like, that was my out, but more than anything, I wanted back in, even though it was horrible.
Okay. I mean, I have another question, which I think I ask almost every guest, either in JW or any doomsday cult.
Yeah.
When these predictions of Armageddon, the world's going to end. So they say, you said that they kept saying it's around the corner.
Yeah.
I don't know if they give you dates, like it's going to happen January 21st. And when they, when those dates come and go and the world's still here, and then they say, okay, well, it's next year, and it's next year, and it's next year. And they just never happen. Do you ever question that this is a bunch of baloney?
Well, so they never told you a date, ever. They just said the world will get worse and worse, and then Armageddon will start, and then there will be suffering like there has never been suffering in the history of mankind. Because when I was a little boy, I remember at meeting one time, they talked about Christians being thrown to lions. And I knew that I would, like, worse things than that would happen. So I would lay in bed and wonder what would be worse than being eaten alive by a lion.
But that was 2,000 years ago when the Romans did that.
Well, that's their teaching. When Armageddon happens, right, even the Holocaust will be nothing compared to Armageddon. It will be the absolute worst. And, you know, when you're afraid, your thinking is survival oriented. You can't scrutinize, you can't analyze because, you know, maybe I dropped something on my foot and I curse. Well, then all day I'm thinking, oh my God, what if Armageddon's tomorrow and I was using profanity? I'll be murdered. Yeah. So you don't have that capacity. Outside of it, it seems utterly absurd, and it is. But when you're in it, it's profound. It's powerful.
And I have to remind myself that when you're brought up in a cult, this is what they brainwash you and drill into you. So
yeah,
you're going to believe this no matter what. As the outsider, I've said this so many times. If somebody keeps telling me tomorrow the world's going to end and it doesn't, it's like, it's the, what's that expression when you cry sheep or cry wolf?
The boy, like, who cried wolf. Yeah.
The boy who cried wolf. It's just,
Well,
at some point you're going to say, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And if they've been saying this since 1800s, you know, well, how long has JW been around? Since the 1800s, so, I think.
I believe the late 1800s, and how they would deal with that is there's a scripture that says the light gets brighter. So God keeps making things clearer and clearer the closer destruction is. And of course, they're always revamping and revealing new things. And when you're in it, it's exciting because, oh my God, yeah, wow, think how close Armageddon must be.
Okay.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I get it.
And yes. You know, when I was 33, a woman I worked with started asking me about my beliefs, and I told her, and she seemed really interested, which I never really, you know, I went door to door. I tried to get out of it as much as I could. I had one study with someone when I was like 15, two or three times. And, you know, but she seemed very, very interested. And so she started coming to meetings, and it was very odd because the congregation really, really liked her, but of course they hated me. And so when it came out that, you know, if she got baptized, or, you know, if she kept progressing in the truth, as they say, that, you know, we were interested in dating, the congregation tried to put an end to that. And so when I was 33, I was pulled into a room and told I could only speak to this woman after meetings at the Kingdom Hall because people are being offended. And yet again, I'm not really the type of person that cares if I offend you. I mean, I don't go out of my way to offend you. But like, if you're offended by how I dress, I mean, I get a life. It doesn't even, it's ridiculous, you know?
I agree. Take a look at me. I got long hair and tattoos, and I've been like this for 20 years. There are people who, when I walked into a doctor's office today for my cardiology, and I'm 65, but everybody in there is 75, 80. You should have heard the gasp of the people that when I walked in there today.
Yeah.
But I don't care.
No.
You know? So it's like enough already.
Well, and you know, there are real things. Is someone a nice person? You know, who cares if it, but, and that was another thing too. I think I got 19 tattoos when I was a Jehovah's Witness, which was, it wasn't explicitly forbidden because it's in the Old Testament. So it's under the Mosaic law. It's more of a conscience matter, but it was viewed as a rebellious act. And if I thought something was stupid, I'm not going to respect it. And that's always been how I am. So I'm told I can't speak to this woman that I'm falling in love with. And it was just utterly ridiculous. And there was no scriptural basis. They, you know, sometimes they, you know, they, here's a scripture, because I did respect the Bible at the time. And but I said, this is personal. And so I wound up being shunned a second time in my life for her. And now, we moved in together, and we lived together about a month before we got married, because yet again, my focus is being reinstated, because now I have a wife and a stepson, and eventually she became pregnant, and that's my focus. And I spent 2 years and either 5 or 7 months, it was, you know, closer to three than two, but yeah, you know, because it has to be longer every time, evidently. And I got reinstated again. But what was different was when once I got married to my ex-wife, she refused to tell her family that we were married. I don't know why. She's never explained it to me. And that was really, really devastating. Yet again, it was, you know, just being true, you know, why did you marry me? But I couldn't leave. I couldn't get a divorce because that's forbidden unless your spouse cheats on you. Even when I told my mother that, she told me to stay and pray and Jehovah would bless my marriage. But he did not bless my marriage. And that was a huge problem for me that I couldn't get over. I just started binge drinking. And even by the time I got reinstated, I had been drunk every day for years. And, you know, I would go to my job, do my job. I wasn't drunk there. But when I got home, I would just drink from the time I got home until I went to bed. And of course, nothing improved in the marriage. It was a terrible marriage. You know, you have to present that illusion. And we still would, you know, go to meetings. We still would go out in service. And, you know, our life, you know, just went on. I have a son that was born in, he was born in 2017. And when COVID happened, I thought that was Armageddon. That was what I had been living in expectation of. Even I worked at a nursing home at the time. So I'm speaking to people who are lucid and coherent, who are in their 80s, and they're telling me, I've never seen anything like this, you know? And so, but also I knew there was something wrong in Jehovah's Witnesses. And even years prior, I had told an elder that I had a plan to kill myself. And he had mocked me and he told me, your life is easy. What are you complaining about? And was just, you know, if a stranger stopped me on the street and told me that, I would show them more compassion. And I mean, I'm not bragging or saying, it just, yet again, you were treated, if they don't like you, like nothing. And a lot of people I grew up with killed themselves. Even that summer when I talked to him, two men I grew up with killed themselves. And what was so horrifying to me when that happened was, nobody cared. It was just, that's what happens when you distance yourself from Jehovah. So once the pandemic was going, and I had kind of got on Reddit and found an ex-Jehovah's Witness page. There were about 70,000 members. And I was reading things about the history that were contradictory to what I had been told and were horrifying. But at the same time, I believe everything outside of Jehovah's Witnesses is controlled by Satan and, you know, maybe he's influencing me. And so my drinking was really exacerbated because I didn't know how to handle that. You know, you aren't taught to grieve and you're also not taught coping mechanisms. Like when I went for a job interview, I didn't prepare. I prayed. Everything was prayer. And if it worked out good, that was Jehovah blessing you. And if it failed, it was because you were useless. So I called that elder and I wanted to clear the air because you're taught to do that, you know, be peaceable with your brother. And he told me he didn't say that. We spoke on the phone, but he said he didn't and that another elder was present. So I asked, you know, was someone listening over the phone? And I realized that he was lying about it, which was troubling because also I was reading about all of the trouble Jehovah's Witnesses were getting legally from protecting pedophiles, because they, when a child is molested, they have the two witness rule and they don't report it because that would reflect poorly on Jehovah. And so that really started to ring truer. And I'm like, man, if he's going to lie about this, well, then maybe, you know, because you think being an elder is evidence of God's blessing. And so I hung up on him and he called me back and he called me boy. And so I flipped out on him. I cussed him out and I said, if you want to call me boy, here's my address and, you know, we can handle this. But so I wound up in the hospital because I had accidentally cut myself and I was screaming at him. And my neighbors called the cops. And when the cops arrived, I smarted off to them. So they put me in a 3-day hold at a, you know, a stress center. So by the time I got out, when I was able to speak to my mother, the elder told her that I had threatened to kill the entire congregation. And I told her, I said, well, that doesn't make sense. If I wanted to kill people, I wouldn't tell them. I mean, and she said that they had reported me to the headquarters and they'd never had anyone ever behave so poorly against the religion. And she hung up on me and blocked me. So yet again, that was painful. And, you know, everything just was crumbling and I was just drinking and drinking. I could not handle it. And I couldn't talk to anybody about it. And in my mind, I'm thinking, well, if it is true and Satan is warping my mind, I'm killing my family. And I didn't know how to handle that. I was just, you know, at a very low point. And so during COVID, I woke up in jail. And I, you know, it was odd. You know, I have a lot of tattoos. I shave my head. And sometimes people, you know, have asked me if I'm a neo-Nazi, which I'm not. It's offensive, you know. But of course, in jail, in that element, you know, that they're going to see that that's what they saw, you know. And so I never caused any problems in jail. I tried to reach out to my mother and I said, look, I've been drunk a long time. I need to quit drinking. And she served me with a no contact order. And of course, it was during COVID. So it was a digital court. But she cherry picked something I had said in my 20s about when I was very suicidal, where I said I wished a cop would kill me. And she had to bring that up, said I had intention to commit suicide by cop. And she said, you know, painted me as a monster. And I remember the judge said, do you have an issue? Or he said, you're not to contact your mother. Do you understand? And I said, yes, I have no issue never speaking to her again. And I didn't. And I still don't. And I didn't have access to my money to hire a lawyer. So I spent 77 days in jail. Of course, the whole process was slower during COVID. So when they came to me with a plea bargain, I signed it. And when I got out, my Mustang had been repossessed. I was homeless. And I spent 3 days being homeless. I did have I was able to sleep inside one of the nights at my home and gather my things. And then I was allowed to, I slept in a car. But that was, I don't know if I've ever experienced fear like that. When you crawl under a bridge and try and find the place where bugs will bite you least so you can be next to your child. You know, I thought about praying, but I just knew that everything that had happened, I did not have any confidence that any God, whether or not they existed, would hear me or help me. So it was terrifying. And I wound up getting into a halfway house. When I was going through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I found a lot of things that I didn't agree with. And I had questions. And the people there hated me. They told me, I mean, I was trying to get people to relapse, which I wasn't. The book preaches predestination. I don't believe in that. I asked for evidence of that. I was told that I thought too much. I was told to trust the process. And it's like, well, I feel like I can trust it if you explained it to me. You know, fool me once, shame on you, but fool me twice. And the more I asked questions, the more people got angry. Now, of course, all of those people were relapsing. I wasn't trying to make anyone relapse. I had no issue not drinking. I didn't want to drink, but I wanted to not believe in something if there wasn't a good reason to. And I,
Mike, I gotta come out to you. I'm in recovery. I have 10 years and it's all due to AA. So I'm very familiar with what you're talking about. You have absolutely no responsibility to those people who relapsed. And it is your right to ask questions. I don't know what group you were going to, but did you have a sponsor?
Yes. The first one relapsed, and he only had about 3 months more than me. And then I had someone without children who'd never been married, who, of course, you know, my ex-wife had filed for divorce. I was catastrophically upset about that. He told me not to think about it. He told me not to think or talk about my children. And when I sat down and I cried in front of the person who ran it, and I said, listen, I know this sounds crazy, but I don't know if I was in a cult or if Satan has warped my mind. And I just need to sit and think. And I was told I just wanted to feel special, that I was terminally unique and a dry drunk. And those shaming terms made me livid, especially when all of these people around me are relapsing and I'm not, and you're telling me I'm the problem. How dare you?
And yeah, no, that's not right.
This time when they came to me with these things, I would flip out. I have screamed at rooms of people because I was livid, because they kept trying to denigrate me when I wasn't doing anything wrong. Because for me, I didn't want to drink, and they kept telling me I had this disease and all of these things. So if that was true, I did not want to ever drink again, because I promised my sons, and it didn't matter.
And Micah, what's the requirement for AA membership?
Well, I know, but that was not my experience. And yeah, so I was evicted and put into a place that is ran by a mob informant who's the son of the former Columbo crime family. And he was in the paper, he ratted on his father. It said, "Rats, my boy." So people were doing cocaine on the porch, and I think crystal, you know, I just had drank. I'd never smoked marijuana. I've never done anything like that. And so I'm hearing stories about heroin, and I'm not judging them. But for me, I can't fathom why you would do that. It's not something that I would be open to. And of course, they're telling me I'm judgmental and saying I'm better. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I was a drunk for years. Like, I'm not proud of that, but it's true. So I was there for a while, and they were, and for me, I just kind of, you know, I was just working. And I also, at the time, I had over $30,000 in debt and, you know, no vehicle. And I was working in a restaurant. Well, a bar was opening up with a lot of games and stuff. And they asked me if I wanted a job, and they offered me more money than I'd ever made. And I said, absolutely, I want a job. At the time, I was on probation. I checked with my parole officer. I asked she was still my wife at the time, but I asked her if she would be comfortable. And I said, I promise you, you know, I'm not going to drink. And I haven't, almost 5 years in September. But some people ask me, you know, are you planning a relapse? And I was like, absolutely not. What I'm planning is repairing my life, and they're offering me good money. But I walked 45 minutes there and back. And then
who would ask you if you're planning on relapsing?
The people I met in AA, I'm not saying everybody involved with it is that way, but I just met horrific person after horrific person. And all of my sponsors kept relapsing. Eventually, my wallet was stolen there, and I was livid. So I called the police, and they came into a halfway house. And then the next day, it miraculously reappeared. Now, of course, I was told that I had misplaced it. When I'm in a room that's barely bigger than a jail cell, and I have OCD, I always put everything back in the same place. But yeah, I was livid. I was like, you're going to steal from me, and I know you're doing drugs. Let's get the police in here. So I contacted the woman who runs where I stay now, which it's kind of like after people have gone through places like that. And I told her, I said, I am an atheist. I don't believe in God, and I've had horrible experiences in AA. I don't want to drink, but I really dislike it. I've just met lots of terrible, abusive people. And she was like, okay, you know, you're not drinking. You know, let's get you in here. So when I moved in here, I actually had a room. I had my own bathroom. I had a key. And I bought a desk, and well, this desk and this chair I'm sitting in off Amazon, had them shipped here. And I just worked and worked, and I have paid off over $30,000 in debt. But go ahead.
Just quickly, we kind of made a left turn there. You ended up in jail, you got out, you went to AA.
Mm-hmm.
Are you still a JW member at this point, or you had left JW, or you were shunned,
no,
or what?
sorry, when I was in jail and I reached out to my mother, I asked for help. I said, could you send me a Bible? Would you contact the elders? You know, this isn't who I am. I mean, I did hit mailboxes, but that was, you know, one stupid teenage mistake. You know, I didn't, that's not the life I want to live. And so they all ignored me. And so I was finished with them. They had hurt me and failed me at every critical point when I needed them. So yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to not mention that.
No, just bridging the gap.
That long stint in jail when you basically severed your ties with JW.
Well, yes, but I still wasn't sure, as I said, that I said to the person who ran that first halfway house, was I in a cult? Or am I this evil, horrible sinner, right?
But at some point you said you were an atheist, so...
I am, and yeah, so anytime I tried to read or research, people in AA would tell me, you're isolating yourself, you're going to relapse. No, I'm researching Jehovah's Witnesses, but, you know, they could not hear me. But once I moved in here, like I said, I had my own space, and so I felt like a shell of a person, honestly, because... You know, when I went to jail, you know, you can't groom yourself how you want. You don't have your own clothing. They treat you like a number. And I get that, you know, what they have to deal with. And then yet again, when I was at AA, no one could hear me. No one could see me. Everyone just acted like I wanted attention. And I'm thinking, I've had so many horrible things happen to me. I wish they hadn't happened to me. Like, I wouldn't wish them on other people, but it, you know, that wasn't what I was just trying to make sense of it all. And it was a very confusing time.
Can I just give you my theory of what happened with your exposure to AA? And then we got to start to begin to wrap up and see where you are today. And so we know JW is a cult. Uh-huh. And I've been in and out of AA for 40 years, and it stuck. The last 10 years, I was able to put 10 years together, and I'm not an AA thumper by any, you know, I can't recite mm-hmm. the big book like some people can. You know, I got my sobriety and I got my higher power, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. There are people who call AA a cult. They say that it's a cult, cult-like. Uh-huh. But the difference between AA and JW or any other cult is AA does not make you do anything. They don't put, they hand you a couple of pieces of paper and say, these are the suggestions that helped us get sober. So the 12 step, the 12 edition, the 12 concept, the promises, and then they hand you a big book and a couple of other, and then they say, get a sponsor and go talk to him and go to meetings. But you don't have to do any of that. You don't get shunned. You don't get beaten. You don't get, you know, whatever. And so that's the difference why it's not a cult. It's just a group of people trying to help each other. The group that you went to, I would have just found another group. Because I don't know what area you were in. But anyway, you had a shock factor. You had a culture factor. You went from a real life cult to a organization that is seen as a cult, but it's not. And mm-hmm. I think that there was some sort of a transitional problem that you had going in there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would say I think Jehovah's Witnesses are far more destructive, but there are.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
A lot of similarities between the two. And honestly, it was the similarities that made me realize I was in a cult because I'm experiencing so much of the same. There's not as much coercive control, but there are a lot of problems with the treatment of people. But, you know.
Yes.
So when I was in here, I researched what are the tactics of a cult. And I thought, and I found about 20s, and I wrote them down, and everyone, it was like it was written about my life, and that was really staggering to me. So I kind of wanted to redefine myself, and that was when I decided that I wanted to write. I had always written, and I had kept a few of my clothes, and I had my laptop with 20 years of writing. That was when I decided to write my memoir and talk about my experience. And I also read through my older poetry and like song lyrics, and I put a poem before each chapter, and that began making me remember more and more of my past. And I ended up, so I published my memoir, Mentally Diseased. Then 6 months later, I published all of my poetry and prose. It's titled Gangrenous Speeches. And then I also wrote a horror novella about the Antichrist to a fictional religion and a hateful God. It's very allegorical for leaving a high control group and it's called despicable. And all of those terms are Jehovah's Witness shaming terms. So that was very cathartic. And because what I came out of, I just realized if I don't feel there is compelling evidence to accept something, I'm not going to. And it really, I became an atheist, I would say easily, not necessarily quickly, because I thoroughly questioned myself and my beliefs because I felt I had been so circumscribed and contrived as a Jehovah's Witness. I didn't really trust anything about myself. So I just started at basic things like, do I believe men and women are equal? I do. With that solitude and over the course of about a year, I wrote my first book. And it's been a very fulfilling thing. It's led to really great things. I also published a 19-page ebook called Zizou, Desolation Before Motivation. And then I was asked to be a part of the Witness Underground crowdfund. I got a producer credit for that on IMDb. So that was a fun thing to tell my son. And, I've continued to write. I've written my son a children's book about critical thought and skepticism. It kind of rhymes like Dr. Seuss. It's called The Boy Who Loved a Monster. And I found another Jehovah's Witness to illustrate it. I'm just saving up to pay them. And then I'm also writing two fictional books. So, it's been a transformative experience, but I certainly feel that it's improved me.
Yeah. You feel liberated now?
I do. What's been really cool is I've had people from all over the world, Finland, Germany, England, message me that they're reading my memoir. One man sent me a passage and said, it's like you wrote the words down that are in my head. And I've been able to talk to people that have just realized they were in a cult and posted a message. It's just been phenomenal because I thought it would be one book, And then people told me, we like your writing style. We'd like to hear more. And that was surprising because, I was always treated like I was nothing. And
maybe Melody would know also, but are you active on social media with all of this?
I am. I used to have a Twitter account, but I was banned once Elon took over.
No great loss there. Trust me.
Oh, yeah. It was down the toilet. I am on Facebook. I am on Instagram. I am on TikTok. I'm on Threads. And I also have a website that I put together. It's MicahAllenLosh.com. My trilogy, my memoir is available in hardcover, paperback, and ebook. And the other two books in the trilogy are ebook and paperback. And, it's crazy because I always relied on my God, but just trying and pursuing what I want and being my authentic self has led to crazy things.
Well, let me ask you this, and then we got to begin to wrap up, really wrap up. And then Melody has a final question for you. So you consider yourself an atheist. Mm-hmm. So you went from Jehovah's Witness to AA, which only requires a higher power. Then you went to an atheist. Do you have a higher power, or you are strictly, there is just no higher power?
Well, so I don't believe there are gods. I don't see any compelling evidence. I'm not going to say there isn't a God.
But higher power doesn't mean God. Higher power just is something greater than yourself.
Well, I know there are plenty of things greater than myself, but I don't want to drink. I don't think I'm a determined person. For me, I think self-reliance is a great thing. I think developing yourself and challenging yourself and doing things that not are reckless, but doing things that frighten you and growth, that's what really interests me and creativity. I understand that some people need that, but I don't. I've had enough of it. And outside of it,
had plenty of
it. Yeah. One person in AA, they were so upset I didn't have a higher power. And I said, well, how about this? I said, my father was a determined man. So that half of my DNA that is him, that's my higher power. Because I didn't get much of anything good from my mother. But my father was a determined man. And he said, okay, that sounds great. Now, I think that's kind of ridiculous. I can't rely on myself, but I can rely on half of myself. But, I don't hate religious people, but I don't respect faith. And I think the things that are good about it are not unique, and the things that are unique are not good. And you don't need that to be a good person or a kind person. You just don't.
And my last thought on AA, and then I'm going to throw it to Melody, is that higher power and that God concept in AA has driven people away from AA because some of the group, now AA, as you know, is a very, each group is autonomous.
So yeah.
Some of these groups, they band together and they make you say the Lord's Prayer at the end and all that kind of crap. I try to avoid those groups. I look for the groups that don't push God down your throat and because that's not where I am. And so I'm just a higher power kind of guy. So, but anyway, you're not going there anymore and you're staying sober. And I congratulate you for that. And 5 years is tremendously amazing.
Well, so I still do because I'm supposed to, you know, but I'm civil and, nearly 5 years. To be fair, I do live in the Bible Belt. So, you know, Christianity is pretty prominent, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But you don't go to the meetings, correct?
No, I do. Yeah. That.
Oh, you do? Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
So, but you know, I think sometimes people kind of fear that I don't believe in God, or a lot of people have asked me.
You know,
have you found a meeting? Have you found a place where you feel comfortable? A group that you feel comfortable with?
No, and I've gone to plenty. I just don't talk to people because they insult me often and whatever. I do like to argue the Bible and point out where people are wrong about things. I don't do that anymore. Yeah. I'm mature.
You can't do that in AA. That's just. But you could. I mean,
you can.
Not a meeting, but you
won't be popular.
There's a lot of AA groups out there that are atheist groups. And if you're in a rural area, you're not going to find them. But look online on Zoom meetings, you're going to find them.
Yeah, I always encourage people to check out Smart Recovery, which is similar, but you know, without the faith element. And because for me, even being like hearing about religion and faith, it's not revolting. It makes my flesh crawl because it gives
triggering.
Me the creep.
It's triggering because of your past and your trauma.
Right. Yeah. And people, they misinterpret that as I'm filled with hatred and I'm filled with judgment. Right. Like, I don't care. Just I don't share your belief. You know, I can accept you think I'm wrong. I think you're wrong. Let's crack on.
Right. Excellent. Okay. We have got to wrap it up. We're over an hour. Okay.
So, Melody. So the last question, Micah, we'll end with this is, do you have, what would be your words of advice to anybody who might be in Jehovah's Witnesses or another group that might be questioning their beliefs, or somebody who might be starting to get involved with a group that they're starting to question? What would be your advice?
Okay. So my advice would be, when you have an emotional investment, that's a really difficult thing to do. And so if you're questioning, what I did was I looked up, what are the tactics that cults use? I looked up logical fallacies, and it was really devastating to me. My thinking was riddled with them. You know, it would just, if you're in a group that's a cult and you read those, if you can be honest with yourself, it's just ubiquitous. That really opened up my mind because, you know, you're not thinking rational. It's fear-based thinking. And if you can just look at that, it's like, wow, you think you're so unique and part of something so unique, the one true religion. And it's like all of this treatment is abuse, you know. And what I would recommend is let go of everything almost. I love my son. I love heavy metal. I love fast cars. But my beliefs, I just let them all go. And I started from the beginning. And, you know, I suffered greatly and went through a lot of stuff.
Good advice.
Yeah. Best thing ever happened to me. Thank you.
Yep. Yeah. And I can totally relate because my group was the House of Yahweh, which we called them Yahweh instead of Jehovah. And we believed in the 144,000. We did the doomsday stuff, all of very similar or parallel beliefs. So I can relate to a lot of where you're at and some of that. So, but Micah, thank you so much for coming on the show and being open and honest and sharing your story with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yes, and thank you so much. And thank you for sharing about the AA. And maybe I'd be more than happy to give you my number, and you can always reach out to me at any time.
Okay. Cool. Well, thanks for having me. Thank you so much, guys.
Yes. Thank you, Micah.
Pleasure.
Yep. Have a good night.
Thank you. You too.
And once again, we want to thank Micah so much for coming on the show and sharing his story with us. I made a note here because I was going to mention this during the episode, but the subject changed and it went by too fast. For anyone who doesn't know or understand, and when Micah was telling the story about his father passing away and that a blood transfusion could have helped him, the Jehovah's Witnesses do not believe in or allow their members to receive blood transfusions. So that may have been a little bit confusing for anybody who might be listening and not know that about Jehovah's Witnesses. So I just wanted to make that clear for anybody who didn't follow that part of the story, that that is part of their teaching or some one of their rules is that you cannot receive a blood transfusion, even if it's a life and death situation.
And this is the must be the fourth JW we've had on. You would know. You would have the count.
Fourth or fifth, something like that.
Fourth or fifth. And each time we have one on, we learn something different or get a different perspective from the guest. And this one was particularly interesting because he was very, very rebellious. I remember that.
Yes. Yes. And I the other thing I wrote down in my notes here was you had asked him about questioning your religion when a doomsday prediction does not come to pass.
Correct.
And he said most of the time they did not actually put dates on it, which I think they did once in the 70s and it came back to bite them in the butt. So I think they quit setting dates.
Yeah. And that was my understanding that they're, because I think maybe I got that from the Seventh-day Adventists. They did, is that the woman from the 1800s?
Ellen White, yes.
Yeah, Ellen White. They had, I believe they predicted actual dates.
They did. And the House of Yahweh did too. The House of Yahweh did it too. And I will say that that did actually cause, I think that was what started causing my dad to have doubts in the House of Yahweh was some of those things that they were predicting were not coming to pass. Like Israel Hawkins had claimed that him and his brother were going to be one of the two witnesses spoken of in the tribulations or in the revelations of the Bible during the tribulations. And actually, his brother ended up dying when we had been there for maybe a year or two, and his brother died. And my dad's like, well, how can this prophecy be true if his brother is now dead? And that's when I think my dad's doubts started creeping in. But I was so indoctrinated, and my mom and my sister were at that point, that we were the ones then making excuses. Well, maybe they just made a mistake. Maybe it's an honest mistake. Yeah. And we still think it's the right place. And
that was my point to Micah. It was, at some point, doesn't somebody wake up and say, all of these dates and all of these prophecies about the world's coming to an end, they don't come true, and then they just gaslight you with more and more. And I explained this in the episode. I keep forgetting that you are so indoctrinated that you believe that you just kind of overlook the logic of it.
Well, it's almost like it's kind of like when you are in a bad relationship, which Andrew, you can relate to that, where you kind of know something's not right in the relationship, but you still justify staying in it.
Yep.
Yeah, you're like...
Very good analogy.
It can't be that bad, or maybe I'm misunderstanding this, or you know what I mean? You allow yourself to be gaslit because you don't want to face that reality because it's harmful to your ego.
Very good analogy because it's exactly what happened to me for almost 18 months. I do remember one thing Micah said about that. He said it doesn't necessarily mean the end of the world, but he said that the world will start to deconstruct, like start to fall apart. And that's when he mentioned the feeding the Catholics to the lions or something like that.
Christians,
so
yeah.
You could, if I was in a cult right now, like JW or pick any of them, and they were doomsday cult, I could look around the world right now and see what's going on in China, what's going on in North Korea. When I say China, they're looking to take over Taiwan or something.
Right.
What's going on in the Midwest and, you know, with the current leadership and the way. We're technically in a world war right now. It's just a cold war. We're in another cold war.
Right.
So at any moment, anything could happen. But I'm not predicting any.
I know what you're saying, Andrew. And the funny thing is that anytime throughout history, they've been able to use whatever is currently going on to say, oh, this is proof. This is proof that the world is getting ready to end. They were doing it 200 years ago. And I'm not saying that this isn't different or this may not be closer to the end. I don't know. I don't claim to know, and I'm not going to claim to know. But they've been predicting it for a long time, and they've been using current events to do just that for a long time. And it's not just Jehovah's Witnesses or Seventh-day Adventists, lots of cults, lots of groups, and lots of just churches or regular mainstream organizations are doing these predictions as well. So it's kind of across the board thing. But the other thing you might want to touch on here in the outro is talking about how Micah actually felt that his AA experience was a little culty, and that was kind of a trigger for him. And I think that you offered, you know, you actually offered to reach out to him if he needed somebody to talk to about sobriety. And I thought that was really, really sweet of you. It, just very nice thing to do to offer that.
That
for
was
him.
That was not the first time that I've heard AA be called a cult. And I only know how much I got into it. And we're recording this a week after the recording. But AA, the difference between AAs is that they give you suggestions. They don't tell you you have to do this. And if you stop going to meetings, nobody's going to come looking. Well, sometimes. In fact, somebody called me last week while I was in Florida. There was somebody else missing who's been a long time coming. And he had like 30-something years. And all of a sudden, they haven't seen him in a couple of months. And they reached out to me to get his phone number because I had his phone number. But we were just curious. Are you okay? Did you relapse? Did you die?
Right.
Did something happen? Did you move? And so, but there's no like all these elders sitting around getting together. It was just one text message from a couple of people wanting to know where he, do I have any information about where he might have gone to? In AA, there is no, we're not a cult. You can come and go.
No, but
as you
I think some of them act culty. If you get the wrong person in charge, yes, you can get it.
He must have gotten somebody that had. We call them AA thumpers or bumper. They go by AA by the book a little too much.
And some of them will actually say, if you leave, you will go back to drinking and you will not stay sober, which isn't always true. Yep. I don't think everybody needs AA to say stay sober, but I think it is very helpful and a very good organization for a lot of people. So I don't want to be an anti-AA thumper either, because I feel like that if that works for you and you're in a group that works for you and is allowing you your autonomy and not impinging on your sovereignty, then certainly I think that that is a good thing for you. And I know it's been very good for you, Andrew. And I don't want anybody to think that we are anti-AA at all, because I know it has helped a lot of people.
And just to jump on that or to clarify that, and then we'll close it up, is that In a month, I celebrate 10 years. And when I first started going to AA, I was going to meetings every day of the week. And they suggest 90 meetings, 90 days, and that kind of thing. But as you get sober and get longer and you do the steps and you do the suggestions, it becomes a way of life. It just so now I go to maybe 2 meetings a week. And that's all I need. I'm comfortable with that.
Right.
You know, the only person that says something to me once in a while is my sponsor. How many meetings you're making? And I look at them and I'm like, hey, I make 2 meetings a week and I'm good with that.
And that's working for me right now.
You get the idea.
Yeah. And that's working
and it's working for me and I'm happy with it. So, okay.
No. So, you know, we just want to clarify that. But I did think that that was an important part of the interview that we should talk about here in the outro.
Correct.
So just to clarify to our listeners where we stand on that subject. But we do thank Micah so much for coming on the show and being real and raw and sharing his experiences. And we want to thank all of you as well for tuning into Cultimatum. As always, your support is greatly appreciated. And if you enjoyed today's episode, if you could just take a moment to rate and review us on platforms such as Apple and Spotify, it does really help us out greatly. And don't forget to follow, share, and keep listening to all of our latest episodes.
You can also connect with us by joining our Facebook group, Cultimatum Podcast, where we dive deeper into these important topics.
And if you are an ex-cult member looking for additional support, hang on, I jumped to the wrong thing. You can also find us on additional social media platforms, including Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok, YouTube, and Threads.
If you have a personal experience with cults or human trafficking that you'd like to share, please reach out to us at cultimatumpodcast@gmail.com.
And if you are an ex-cult member in need of additional support, you can consider joining the Cult Escape and Recovery Group on Facebook.
If you'd like to hear more from me, you can check out my other podcast, Digital Dating with Anonymous Andrew, available where you're hearing this podcast, Apple and Spotify and Amazon and all the rest. If you'd like to help, I'm going to be doing a lot of editing on this one. If you'd like to help...
Oh, goodness.
Okay. Hey, folks, it's Sunday morning.
It happens.
If you'd like to help us out with the cost of maintaining the podcast, you can show your support through Buy Us a Cup of Coffee link in our show notes, which I would like just to quickly touch upon. We have had a couple of donations so far in the last couple of weeks. So it's working. And although we're talking like, you know, $5, $10 here and there, which we absolutely appreciate, but we need more. So
yes,
in the show notes, you will
but
see.
A shout out to those. A shout out to those who have donated us.
A big shout out and thank you to those who have donated. So every little bit helps in our mission to spread awareness about cults and human trafficking.
And as always, stay safe, stay informed, and remember, you are not alone.